Guardian Unlimited.
Jump and Jive, 35. Rise and Shine, 49. Demi Big E, number 3.
Bingo! Bingo, in your face, Randerson. Hello there. I'm Alok Jha. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. And yes, that definitely is the first mention of Debbie McGee since 1987. Anyway. Pick a letter, any letter. We speak with Alison Pern from the Darwin Correspondence Project to try and find out more about the granddaddy of evolution. Plus, as scientists discover a mysterious halo around a galaxy far, far away, we'll attempt to get to the bottom of dark matter. Well, someone has to. And one man, a beard and a guitar. Yes, our troubadour physicist, Johnny Berliner, is back. I think you'll like this. Not a lot, but a little. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Now, try as I might, I can't do this show alone, so without further ado, let me introduce the multi-talented Science Weekly pod squad. First up, fresh from his stag do and sporting an assorted selection of bruises in peculiar places, science correspondent James Randerson.
Ouch.
Returning for a second show in as many weeks, and we feel as blessed by his presence as you, dear listeners, it's Dr. Ian Sample.
Always a pleasure.
And the only man to combine physics and music and get away with it, it's the magnificent Johnny Berliner. Give us a twang, please, Johnny. And finally, hello to Science Weekly producer Ben Green. Ben, please do your thing.
Love letters straight from your heart. Keep us so near while apart.
Ben, I'm getting worried about you. First Debbie McGee, then a Paul Daniels gag, and now Cilla Black. It's like a bad night of ITV in the early 90s. Anyway, they're not quite love letters, but a new database of Charles Darwin's correspondence with his colleagues, family and friends. And last week, they were made available online. The letters give a truly amazing insight into how his masterwork, The Origin of Species, took shape, and give a rich picture of Darwin the student bounder, Darwin the husband, Darwin the grieving father, and many more. Well, our special guest in the pod this week is Alison Pern from Cambridge University Library's Darwin Correspondence Project. Alison, welcome to the pod. Let's talk a bit about the Darwin Correspondence Project to start with. How big's this new database and how long have you been working on it?
We've got exactly 5,224 complete letter texts in the database at the moment. That's out of more than 14,500 letters that we actually know of that still survive. The project actually started as a print project more than 30 years ago now. What's gone online is all the letters from the first 13 of what will eventually be a 30-volume set.
And the idea is to let people read sort of his thoughts and the arguments he was having whilst coming up with what turned out to be a very groundbreaking theory. Who did he write to? What kinds of things was he talking about?
All sorts of different people. There are names people will recognise. There's Charles Kingsley. There's George Eliot. There's a woman called Lydia Becker, who's not very well known now, but she was actually a leading suffrage campaigner. But she wrote to Darwin because she was also interested in botany, and she'd made some observations that she thought helped support a theory that he'd published. So she wrote to Darwin, and he wrote back. And they exchanged, you know, sort of a dozen or so letters. The great thing about the correspondence actually is just the breadth of the people he was corresponding with.
Here is one of those letters. This is Darwin writing to his Cambridge chums on the eve of the Beagle voyage.
My dear Whitley, I received your letter some days ago, and to my grief you'll see by my direction it's impossible to pay Cambridge a visit for some years to come. Long indeed will it be before I see such a set as used to meet at your most classical Sunday evenings. My feelings overpower me when I think of the simple, the elegant Glutton Club, and that day of victory, triumph, and inward glorying, which some call sublime, but the wise know it to be the full round feeling from a contented dinner. Oh, Lord, what a jolly place Cambridge is. Ah, the man has just come for the letters, and here I have been writing like a confounded fool. I've no time for any more. Give my very, very best wishes to Herbert and Watkins. When I think of you and some few others, I must do one of two things, either be bona fide melancholy or talk like a fool. Yours very affectionately, C. Darwin.
Charles Darwin there. He just sounds a lot like, you know, one of our producers, doesn't he? You've been looking at these letters, James, this week.
That's right. I was just thinking to myself, though, that that was on the eve of probably the most significant gap year in history. But anyway, well, there were lots, actually, that came out. But there was one that I thought found really moving, which is where he's writing to his best friend, Joseph Hooker, the botanist and director of Kew Gardens. And this is at the time his son, I think, has just got scarlet fever. And a few months previously, he'd lost a daughter to illness. And Darwin had suffered the same thing when one of his offspring had died as well. And at the end of the letter, he says, "Much love, much trial, but what an utter desert is life without love." It's just a really beautiful phrase.
Alison, one of the things that obviously getting all these letters and things will reveal, hopefully, is a bit more about Darwin's character. Are there things in the analysis that people have done so far which sort of reveal things that kind of would surprise people or reveal something about him that we don't know?
I think his sense of humour. Another thing we did recently was to commission a dramatisation of some of the correspondence. That really came out, and the guy who did it for us, Craig Baxter, who's a professional dramatist specialising in science subjects, did a fantastic job. He uses only the Darwin's own words taken from the letters, taken from reminiscences and of the correspondence. And people laugh, you know, you've got people rolling in the aisles because it's funny stuff.
But when you read the letters, does Darwin come across as the kind of person, you know, you get on with?
Absolutely.
Does he come across as, doesn't come across as one of those sort of austere, sort of nasty scientists from the 16th century?
No, absolutely, definitely not. He's actually a genuinely nice man.
And he's never been more relevant now. You've got people like Richard Dawkins and Steve Jones fighting the good fight about showing that evolution didn't occur by natural selection and using all of their sort of scientific wiles to prove Darwin correct in the face of, you know, dare I say it, intelligent design, which we haven't mentioned on the podcast for a few weeks now. We've done really well, I think.
Very restrained, yeah.
But, you know, he's been never been more relevant. So how do you think this sort of massive information about how actually Darwin himself had lots of problems with what he was coming up with and had internal battles with himself and his religion about evolution. How is this going to help sort of the cause of science?
Well, we hope so. The aim is to put up the materials so that people can see for themselves what Darwin believed, what he actually said. We actually have started a number of special content areas on our site. When the first time we've really done this, and we've started with Darwin and religion, and if you go to the site now, there's the first section of that is up, and that's on design in nature, and Darwin's personal belief. It will be the next one that goes up.
Well, Darwin was quite religious, was he?
No. No, but I tell you, I every now and then I get obsessed with a letter, and the one I'm obsessed with at the moment is one that we're publishing in the next volume. But it was to a chap called John Innes, who was the vicar of Darwin's parish, but was an absentee vicar. He was a good friend of the Darwins, and Darwin had loads of friends who were clergy. Anyway, Innes was away up in Scotland, and the parish had had a succession of disastrous curates. They'd been embezzling, they'd been womanising. And Darwin was really worried about that. He cared about the fabric of the established church.
Thanks for that, Alison. We'll hear more from you later on in the show. For more about the Darwin Project, go to darwinproject.ac.uk. I'm Alok Jha, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, Daniel Gilbert's Stumbling into Happiness won this year's prestigious Royal Society Prize for Science Books. We'll speak to one of the judges to find out what set his book apart from the competition. Plus, dark matter does matter, and we're going to try and explain it to you, maybe even by the power of song. But first, it's time for a roundup of the other science news that's been making headlines over the past 7 days. This is your News Jam.
News Jam. The government signalled a U-turn on plans to outlaw the creation of animal-human embryos. The plans have been heavily criticised by scientists, including the government's own chief scientific advisor, Sir David King. They say embryos are vital for stem cell research. But despite the pro-science rhetoric, the Department of Health didn't actually include the change in the draft fertility bill, which was published last week.
Cancer survival rates in the UK have doubled over the past 30 years. A study at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine found that a cancer patient now has a 46% chance of surviving for 10 years after they're first diagnosed.
One of the most important of the natural sponges that soak up carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is working 30% less efficiently than a quarter of a century ago. The Southern Ocean is responsible for soaking up the annual CO2 contribution of the UK and the Netherlands combined, but higher winds over the ocean, caused by climate change, have hampered the ocean's ability to act as a carbon sink.
And finally, there's new hope for the follically challenged. A treatment for hair loss may be within sight after healthy hair-producing follicles were regenerated in adult skin in mice. The treatment works by reawakening a sequence of dormant genes, which trigger a flood of stem cells into patches of hairless skin.
And that was your News Jam. Thank you to James and Ian and Johnny, who made us those stings. Don't know about you, but I've got some questions about those stories. Ian, on the human-animal embryos issue, this sounds like a bit of a government fudge. They're kind of backtracking, but they still haven't put the legislation correct. What's happening there?
They've copped out. Their position has been that they want to ban all animal-human embryo research. So what they've done with the draft bill is they've produced that. It still bans everything. But then in the introduction, they say, we'd really like to have exemptions on three different types of these things. And they're going to pass it off to a cross-party committee, parliamentary committee, and say, you decide.
Which will try and fix it later or something.
Yeah, they're passing the buck.
Okay. James, the Southern Ocean, the fact that it's not absorbing as much carbon dioxide as before, tell me, is this one of those scary tipping point stories?
Well, kind of. It's not quite correct to call it a tipping point because it's not going to reach the point where hell's going to break loose or something like that. But the way the system's working is that there is a positive feedback going on, which means that as the climate warms, the Southern Ocean becomes less able to soak up CO2 because of this wind mechanism. So yeah, it's worth worrying about, but it's not quite correct to call it a tipping point.
So it's not going to destroy all of our attempts to sort of cut down carbon or something.
No, but I mean, having said that, it's a very significant amount of CO2 that it's able to soak up, as we said, you know, UK and Netherlands put together. So it's a lot of CO2.
And well, from that to this is a bit of an interesting one, Ian. This story about regrowing hair. You seem to have pissed off a load of bald people. What's going on? Explain yourself,
no,
man.
No, I have.
Can I just say, on the Communist Free blog, Ian was actually called a beaver-fonted fop. Was that right?
Yeah, that's right. I've got the article here, so I think I should.
Why don't you just read us a bit of it, and then Ian can explain.
It's from one of the Guardian comment writers, Stuart Jeffries, who, as it happens, is bald.
He's bald, yeah.
And he says he's got a photo of Ian, you know, on his desktop. I mean, you know, not a weird way. He's called it up to see what Ian looks like, having read the story. And he says, just look at that smile, the smile of a non-follically challenged man basking in his hairy pomp. Damn you, Sample! Stop playing with our hopes, you befonted fop.
There's one thing I can say, that Ian is as far away from being a fop as possible. Obviously, in this particular pod, we don't have any problems with hair. But Ian, what have you done?
It's quite extraordinary. Of all the things I've written about in sort of more than 10 years in journalism, from sort of abortion to, you know, all these things, this is the most vitriolic sort of... it's probably not really that vitriolic. I think he actually has a point to be incredibly fair and guardian about this, in that there are science stories that can sell hope, and these hopes are extraordinarily long way away. I mean, being able to cure a mouse of baldness might not yet cure Stuart Jeffries of baldness, and it's not, you know, the word cure is even very loaded, so I'm actually with him a long way on this. And I have to say, I come from a long line of incredibly bald men. Both of my brothers are bald, my dad was bald, my granddad was bald, his grandfather was bald, and bald from a very young age. So I almost expect this sort of genetically imminent.
Splendid work, one and all. If you are out there in Podland, want to add anything to any of these topics, send us an email or post a comment on the blog. More details coming up at the end of the show. Now then, people, please be upstanding. And gentlemen, remove your hats. Some sad news to report. The magnificent New Scientist podcast seems to have put the faders down on the microphones for the final time. Don't worry, New Scientist podders, you've always got a space on our podcast. It means that we're now almost certainly, if not officially, the number one science podcast on iTunes, or at least we think we should be. So we're pretty pleased about that. Anyway, someone who knows a thing or two about the science of happiness is Daniel Gilbert. And what a tremendous link that was. Last week, he won the prestigious Royal Society Prize for Science Books for stumbling upon happiness, a scientific exploration of the various ways people attempt to make themselves more smiley. Daniel's probably feeling chipper himself, what with 10 grand cash prize, and people now rushing out to buy his book. But what set his work apart from the other main contenders, like our favourite Henry Nichols' story on Lonesome George? Well, James spoke with the BBC's science and environment correspondent, Christine McGerty, who was one of the judges on the panel, to find out more.
Well, it's really funny and brilliantly written. And that's not often you come across books, science books, that really make you laugh out loud and are written with real elegance. And it's a wonderful mixture of the sciences. There's a lot of psychology in there and neuroscience as well, a bit of economics, a bit of philosophy thrown in. It pulls all those together beautifully. It's the kind of book you could literally read pretty much one sitting and really enjoy.
And were the judges sort of fairly unanimous about it, or was there a huge row?
There wasn't a huge row. I would say there was lots of lively discussion. We all really liked the book. Just hard not to. It's so well written and such a fun read. Our meeting that day to decide on the winner did go on for several hours. So we all loved the book and we all did agree that it should be the winner. But all the other shortlisted books all had loads going for them. So
what stood out for you about the others?
I particularly loved was In Search of Memory by the Nobel Prize winner Eric Kandel. That was about his life as well as about his work, and went into detail about the history of the biology of the mind, covered neuroscience, psychology, his background living in Vienna, and then escaping during the Second World War to America. Quite a lot of personal history and a lot of 21st century history and wonderful stories about his life in science, and that's a wonderful read as well.
And do you know how the shortlist this year compares with previous years? Is this a sort of bumper crop?
Well, I've reported on the shortlists for years, actually, for BBC News, and I'd like to say this is definitely one of the best. So, actually, I went into the judging meeting that morning we made the decision, really thinking that I would be pretty happy if any of those books won.
That was Christine McGerty, the BBC's Science and Environment correspondent, and one of the judges for the Royal Society Prize for Science Books. Now that tune you're listening to is called Dark Matter by Liquid Fingerstyle. Yes, really. And if you're able to correctly identify it, well, quite frankly, I don't believe you. Dark matter is, of course, one of the most complex scientific problems to explain, let alone understand. It refers to a substance that's never been seen, but accounts for nearly all the mass in the universe. Scientists have been attempting to find it for over 70 years, but because dark matter doesn't emit or reflect light, it's proved impossible to observe directly. But there may be a breakthrough. Last week, NASA announced they've discovered a halo around a distant cluster of galaxies, which they've observed with the Hubble Space Telescope.
In 2004, an international team of astronomers pointed Hubble towards the constellation of Pisces, the fish, to observe a galaxy cluster that goes by the telephone number of CL0024+17, and which is located 5 billion light-years away from Earth. Now, Hubble's advanced camera for surveys produced a stunning image of this cluster. Analyzing the image over the last couple of years, the team discovered a ring of dark matter and realized that the position of this ring did not match at all the position of the hot gas and the galaxies in the cluster. The ring itself is 2.6 million light years across. Now, this is the first time that dark matter has been found with a distribution that is so radically different from the distribution of the ordinary matter.
That was Dr. J, a.k.a. Dr. Joe Liska, on the NASA ESA Hubblecast. We've put a link to the entire video on the blog. Well, we've got Ian and our troubadour physicist, Johnny Berliner, here to help us try and get to the bottom of this subject. Ian, I'm going to come to you first. Your story appeared in The Guardian on Tuesday and set a subbing record, I believe, of how long it took to get through the system and how many people had to try and understand it. Why don't you try and get us, in a few words, what's so exciting about this discovery?
When you're stumbling home tonight and you look up at the sky okay, you'll see a bunch of stars, and then, you know, we've all seen images on the from various telescopes and so on of all of the planets and nebula and things like this. You think that everything you've seen from space is only 3-4% of everything that we can see. So everything that astronomers can observe, that's just 3-4% of the matter. So there's 96-97% of stuff that we can't even see because it doesn't emit or absorb electromagnetic radiation. So it's this dark matter or dark energy. So there's two types, dark matter and dark energy, make up all the rest. A substantial amount of the mass of the universe is dark matter. We don't even know what it's made of. We can't see it properly.
This new discovery is this shell around these clusters. We'll come to what it is in a second, but this is comes just after another quite important discovery about dark matter in January.
Yeah, in January, Richard Massey at Caltech produced a wonderful map of staring out to space with the Hubble telescope, and he showed where dark matter was clustering around galaxies, and he produced a lovely map of where this stuff was. And the way you look at it is you see how it bends light from the galaxies behind. So you know the galaxies behind should be a certain shape, and they're shining. And you can see the distortion, so you can kind of work out where the dark matter must be, because the dark matter is bending the light because it's so massive. It has a gravitational pull. But you can't see it directly. What was new about this latest study was they'd watched what happens with light as two clusters of galaxies collided. And when they collide, the dark matter gets shifted out. So it's almost exposed on its own. So you can see its effects on light without the interfering galaxies, because obviously the galaxies, all the planets and stars, have a gravitational field as well.
So the first sort of, I suppose, indirect or direct evidence of this stuff. Now, I'm going to come to you, Johnny. You're sort of shaking your head over there. You don't believe dark matter actually exists. Now,
well, I'm open to the idea, but I think the words dark matter often really kind of mean there's stuff going on that we don't know, so we'll call it dark and pretend that maybe it's down to matter, because all we've seen is distortions from light. We haven't actually detected any matter. It could be that we don't know about how light works going through the universe, and there's no matter to find at all.
So a much more fundamental problem with all the laws of physics, which I'm sure that we're not going to get to the bottom of in this particular podcast. But Ian, whatever this stuff is, as Johnny says, we don't know what it is at all, but what are the candidates for what dark matter might be, or how these the light's being sort of bounced around the universe?
There are loads of candidates, but the sort of the prime ones which are still being considered, if you are going to assume that this stuff is matter, and if it's matter, it's some kind of particle and it exists. Yeah, I mean, maybe gravity changes over long distances or something else. But so there are two sort of key suspects that people are looking at, mostly the axion, which was proposed by Frank Wilczek at MIT back in the 70s. And he named it after a washing powder because he said
it does sound like a washing powder.
Yeah, he said it helped clean up, the great physics joke, this big problem in particle physics called
physicist
CP violation.
Jokes. Jesus.
They really know how to.
Yeah, he's a fun guy. And the other one being neutrino, which is a sort of supersymmetric particle, this idea that every particle we do know about in the universe has a heavy partner that we can't see. Sounds like another fudge. I appreciate.
So basically, if the rules don't fit your evidence, then you just create new rules, basically. Now, there is a bit of hope here. The Large Hadron Collider, this massive particle accelerator in CERN, is going to hopefully switch on at the end of the year to try and find all these new particles and things. Potentially, that could discover some of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, if you turn Einstein's equation E equals mc squared on its head, you've got, you know, if you have a lot of energy, then from that you can create mass. So if you smack some particles together at incredibly high energies, which Fermilab's now doing, which LHC is going to do at a higher energy, you may be able to produce some of these particles, because you'll have a lot of energy that can turn into mass, and out might pop one of your particles. It may be very, very ambitious to say that, but that's what some people are hoping.
Including one of these supersymmetric particles, which could explain dark matter. Well, good stuff. I'm going to take a deep breath myself, but I'm not sure we've covered really every last aspect for our listeners. Johnny B., anything to add?
When you look up at the sky at night, you're seeing a mystery. The physicists are in a twist about the forming of the galaxies. It's a very heavy issue. It's an issue of gravity. It's a dark, dark matter. 'Cause there needs to be a substance that we're just not detecting. But it's hard to find material that just ain't reflecting. Or maybe it's our theories just need some correcting. It's a dark, dark matter. So what does it feel like, and how does it smell. If you had some in a bucket, how could you tell? Could you sit on it, or sculpt it, or eat it as well? It's a dark, dark matter. No, they haven't got a clue what the stuff consists of. It's not made from any particles that they have a list of. And now it's really pissing all the cosmologists off. It's a dark, dark matter. So what does it feel like, and how does it smell? If you had some in a bucket, how could you tell? Could you sit on it, or sculpt it, or eat it as well? It's a dark, dark matter. And it's a dark matter. Yeah, what does it feel like, and how does it smell? If you had some in a bucket, how could you tell? Could you sit on it, or sculpt it, or eat it as well? It's a dark, dark matter. Well, they found that finding evidence was fairly demanding. It stretched us to the limits of our understanding. Then it opened up a can of worms about why the universe is still expanding at an accelerating rate. It's a dark, 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 dark matter!
Johnny B, you're a genius. Okay, we're almost done for another week. Before we wrap up, let's hear what you've been telling us over the past 7 days. First up, Fotis written in to say...
I'm sure that was completely different, Alok, on many questions the other week, and that he's not pimping himself out to other GU podcasts to keep himself in hair products.
You think they pay us for this sort of stuff? Yes, indeed, that was me in the audience of the Guardian's rather fine new comedy podcasts. Head to guardian.co.uk/manyquestions for strong opinions and strong language. And much better jokes than we have. Sorry, Ben, it's true. Anyway, we've also had a message from someone who calls himself the International Man of Dysentery.
When all avenues of procrastination have been exhausted, the realisation that there is a new episode of Science Weekly to catch up on provides a joyous feeling matched only when one remembers that one has some Jaffa cakes in one's coat pocket.
He's absolutely right. In the words of Basil Fawlty, a satisfied customer, we should have him stuffed. Our final message this week comes from a certain C. Darwin from the Galapagos Islands.
My dear Hooker, I cannot help it. I must thank you for your affectionate and most kind note. My head will be turned. By Jove, I must try and get a bit modest. I was a little chagrined by review. I hope it was not Woodward. As advocate, he might think himself justified in giving argument only one side. But the manner in which he drags in immortality and sets the priests at me and leaves me to their mercies is base. He would on no account burn me, but he will get the wood ready and tell the black beasts how to catch me. I will not say to soul that he is author. You've cockered me up to that extent that I now feel I can face a score of savage reviewers. Your would-be modest friend, C.D.
Reminder, of course, that Alison Penn from the Darwin Correspondence Project at the Cambridge University Library is here with us in the pod. Alison, that was another letter from Darwin sent to his best friend, the botanist Joseph Hooker. Can I just ask you finally, I guess, in all of the sort of letters that you've seen so far, and you've probably seen most of them, I'm guessing, or at least a good fraction, what are your favourite bits and the things that you think stand out the most?
It's almost impossible to have a favourite because there are so many. I think because what the letters do is give you Darwin, the human being, Darwin, the person who has a domestic life, a family life. One of the great ones is when he's writing to Hooker again. Hooker's wife's just had a baby. Darwin says, did you administer the chloroform yourself? They obviously weren't absentee fathers. They were there at the birth. And he carries on, when I did, I thought it was as composing to oneself as to the patient.
James, what about you? Any other examples?
Well, the real classic is when he finally kind of plucks up the courage to start telling people about the theory that he's kind of been gestating for all these years. And he writes to Hooker at this stage. He didn't know Hooker very well. It was very early on in their sort of relationship. And he says, it's a weird letter, actually, because the letter starts off with this whole kind of what now seems rather trivial stuff about collecting and all the rest of it. And then only at the end does he sort of say, oh, by the way, I've got this idea. But the most significant bit, he says, I'm almost convinced, quite contrary to the opinion I started with, that species are not, it is like confessing to a murder, immutable. I love the way he's sort of tortured as he says it.
Well, the beginning of a profound revolution in science. Oh, look, who's just walked in? Nell, where have you been?
Sailing the high seas.
Every day. You've got a question for Alison, though.
Yeah, I was just wondering whether you'd been involved in any analysis of the correspondence as such.
Well, we've actually given our data to two physicists who were interested in patterns of communication, and there was a paper in Nature looking at the correspondence of Darwin and of Einstein. And how they used their correspondence, and actually saying it was very like the way we use email.
Was that surprising?
No, not at all.
See, lots of junk and nonsense, random nonsense and thoughts and things.
I'll tell you one thing, it was a good postal service. You can do a lot if you've got a good postal service.
Okay. Just a final thing. Around the pod, there's been a lot of correspondence from sort of prominent scientists released recently. I mean, the Darwin thing is quite large. And then, James, you remember the Einstein letters, not only his scientific letters, but also his love letters to various mistresses and so on. Anyone got any fantasy ideas here for scientists that should have their correspondence revealed, or would you like to see?
I'd quite like the idea of reading Archimedes.
Archimedes.
You know, it's like, you know, I was having a bath and then this brilliant idea. And then it all got a bit embarrassing as I ran down the street.
I need to think of a word to explain it.
Yes.
Johnny B?
I reckon a bit of Niels Bohr. He had some fairly wacky ideas. I reckon he'd have some good letters.
Oh, I know someone who owns a Niels Bohr letter.
Oh, really? Well, there you go. It's good
Let's
to have people like
collections.
People like Alison are really useful to have in this situation. Yeah. Ian?
I quite like the letters from the man I can't remember the name of, the guy who tried to weigh the soul, because he started, some very strange experiments with dogs as well. I've got one of the original papers, actually, and was reading through it, and the experimental methodology is absolutely appalling. But I think he would have been so much fun to have look at his letters, because he was just absolute maverick.
Nell, who would be your sort of dream scientist, philosopher, whatever, to get correspondence of?
It would have to be Dan Dennett.
Why?
Because I love the way he writes, and I think he's an incredibly intelligent
man. Do you think he still writes letters, though? He's probably got email.
maybe he has email. Can I see his email?
You can see his email, so we'll sort that out for you. Alison, I'll leave the last word to you. What would you like to see next?
Oh, I've been sort of trumped, because I was going to say Pythagoras.
Pythagoras.
I think one of the older guys would be really, really good to see some of that stuff.
That's it, ladies and gents, boys and girls. If you want to get in touch about anything we've discussed, email science@guardian.co.uk, head to the blog, or make your way over to myspace.com/guardianscience. If you've enjoyed this week's show, why not investigate the Science Weekly back catalogue? You'll find a full archive of every programme we've ever done at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts. Find out why we're probably about to become the number one science show on the net. My thanks, as ever, to everyone in the pod, James Randerson, Ian Sample, and our special guest, the superb Johnny Berliner, and Alison Pern from the Darwin Correspondence Project. We've put links up to both of them on the blog. Anyway, Science Weekly is produced by Ben Green, who worked very hard to make everything sound extra good this week. Well done, Ben. And I've been Alok Jha. I'm off to play some more bingo.
Guardian Unlimited.